Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Not to point fingers, but it's all your fault. Not you, more all of us you. Global warming I'm talking about. A UN panel said today it's 90% certain human beings are changing the climate. That's bad in so many ways. For some, bad enough to pay to change minds. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Fellows. Millions of businesses worldwide choose Fellow shredders for their shredding needs. Fellows, for information protection you can depend on. More at fellows.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday today, the 2nd of February. Great to have you with us. And I wish we could start with something more uplifting heading into the weekend. But predictions from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change are bleak. Rising global temperatures, more floods, droughts, and hurricanes, melting polar sea ice, and damage to the climate system for 1,000 years to come. Grim news for all of us. Worse, in the short term at least, for those who make their money from fossil fuels, including oil giants like ExxonMobil, which is why it's interesting that an Exxon-funded think tank has been offering scientists and economists cash to question this morning's report. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
The conservative Washington think tank, the American Enterprise Institute, sent letters last July offering scientists and economists $10,000 to write critical reviews of the UN climate change assessment. AEI wanted them to explore the limitations of climate models that predict global warming scenarios. Stephen Hayward, who wrote the letters, defends the think tank.
The idea that this is bribery is preposterous. I mean, it defies comprehension that senior scientists with a reputation on the line, with a long record of publications, could be induced to change their mind or say something they don't believe for $10,000. Some people must have a pretty low opinion of scientists and academia if they think that's what would do it.
It's a targeted action aimed at undermining the credibility of the findings of the IPCC.
Kurt Davies is research director for Greenpeace USA.
Because they know full well that the IPCC is the most important, most august body in the world around global warming science and policy.
Davies calls AEI's actions a last-ditch effort by the Carbon Club to cast doubt on climate change. The think tank has close ties to the White House, and former ExxonMobil head Lee Raymond serves on its board of trustees. But Purdue University atmospheric science professor Kevin Gurney says that's the least of his concerns when it comes to AEI trying to pay scientists.
I would worry that policymakers, will misunderstand what is and is not work that has the strength of peer review behind it.
Gurney says AEI's solicited critiques would circumvent that time-honored peer review process, potentially misinforming the policy responses to climate change. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
The fossil fuel-driven U.S. economy is humming right along, and if Federal Reserve Chief Ben Bernanke could snap his fingers and conjure up the perfect recovery, it might look a lot like what's happening right now, a growing economy without much inflation. The January unemployment report came out this morning. There was a decent number of new jobs, about 110,000 in all. The unemployment rate ticked up 0.1% to 4.6%, but wages didn't go up much, which Bernanke and company will read as inflation still not being a huge problem. There are inflationary pressures galore at the White House, though. The president's due to release his 2008 budget on Monday. Attached to it will be a second supplemental request for this year's war expenses, another $93 billion. Add to that the $70 billion Congress has already approved, and 2007 becomes far and away the most expensive year yet for the war. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports on the numbers with all those zeros behind them.
Members of Congress complain this is the fourth year the White House has paid for the war through emergency budget requests. Steve Koziak is a military budget analyst at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He says the White House is sneaking in non-emergency items in the supplemental requests.
There's some concern these war-related spending measures are starting to include funding for weapon systems like the Joint Strike Fighter, for example, that really are part of the administration's long-term defense plans and not really war-related costs.
But for next year at least, the White House seems to have gotten the message. It's giving in to congressional demands that it start funding the war using the regular budget process. For 2008, the administration is asking for $145 billion. Not enough, according to Lawrence Korb at the Center for American Progress.
I think it sounds way low unless the president's going to call off a surge, as the Congressional Budget Office pointed out yesterday. The president's surge or increase of 21,500 troops is only combat troops. If you put support troops in there, that number is probably doubled, which means the cost that the president estimated is going to be much more than he told us.
Korb suspects the president might be lowballing the estimate for 2008 in order to bypass congressional war critics.
Then he can come back during the fiscal year and ask for more, and the Congress will be put in the uncomfortable position of not funding ongoing operations.
In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Shares of the media conglomerate Viacom jumped almost 2% today after the company that owns MTV and Comedy Central made some of its content less available. Viacom ordered the video sharing site YouTube to take down more than 100,000 pirated video clips. Janet Babin has more now from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
A lot of people head to YouTube in search of funny. This week, one of the most popular videos on the site came from The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
Please welcome to the program, Bill Gates!
Stewart's interview with Gates initially aired on Comedy Central, a paid TV network owned by Viacom. It was posted illegally on YouTube, likely by a viewer. Viacom said in a statement it wants YouTube and its parent company Google to start sharing the ad revenue they get when people watch Viacom shows on the site. Until they do, the clips must come down. YouTube has revenue-sharing deals with CBS and other media companies. James McQuivey with Forrester Research says it's likely Viacom was offered a similar deal but turned it down because Viacom knows its content is worth more.
Viacom provides, through Comedy Central, some of the content that gets the highest ratings on YouTube. And Viacom is saying, look, if you're drawing such a great audience from our content, we want a piece.
But just as Viacom's content is vital to YouTube, its shows become even more popular by appearing there. It's like free marketing. Cardozo Law professor Justin Hughes says all the big media companies face a balancing act with their content.
You have to weigh allowing a certain amount of unauthorized use, which actually is good for you promotionally, against allowing too much unauthorized use, which starts to cannibalize your own sales.
Hughes says it's likely the two companies will continue to try to negotiate a deal. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Kind of a fizzle to end what had been a whiz-bang week on Wall Street. We'll have the details and a chat with that stockbroker down in Dallas when we do the numbers. Chinese President Hu Jintao was in Sudan today. He stopped in at a Chinese-built oil refinery there. Hu's on an eight-country tour through the continent to shore up trade ties because China's using tons of raw materials to fuel its industrial expansion. But he took the opportunity to do a little diplomacy, too. He gave Sudan's president a gentle lecture on the genocide in Darfur. Commentator Benjamin Barber says it's a mistake to read too much into that, to hope that it might lead to tough American talk on China's human rights record.
If America wants a peaceful and stable world in which capitalism can flourish and free markets can succeed, China holds the key. Today, China needs us, we need China. But for a partnership to work, we have to understand that Tibet and Taiwan are, for the Chinese, not rights issues, but national integrity issues. Not a reflection of communist authoritarianism, but of an age-old Chinese fear of losing its grip on the three ancient kingdoms of traditional China. If we can grasp that, we can be the good guys in China as it inches its way towards greater openness and democracy. We can help the Chinese build a strong middle class and a broad safety net to help make capitalism stable and trade fair as well as free. For Chinese capitalism today faces many of the same challenges confronting American capitalism. Surging prosperity, but increasing inequality. A public sector that can't keep up with the social costs of the private sector. Pollution, overdevelopment, oil dependency. An aging population whose needs outstrip the state's resources. And a rabid hyper-consumerism. And remember, economics impact stability. The growing inequalities between the 400 million people living in the modern coastal cities and the 900 million people living in the endless inland villages threaten not just capitalism, but the integrity of the country. What the Chinese most fear is neither freedom nor democracy, but disintegration. Reassure them about that, and they may be more accommodating than we might imagine. But for this to happen, we cannot play games in the name of a misplaced rights doctrine. This will not only jeopardize our relations, but put at risk not only democracy in China, but the long-term stability of capitalism and free markets everywhere.
Benjamin Barber runs the nonprofit Democracy Collaborative. Please feel free to share your comments with us. Go to marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. All is right with the world. David Johnson is back in Dallas, Texas. Mr. Johnson, how are you?
And I'm mighty happy to be back. It was a great trip. I love Europe, but I'm telling you, we were sitting in the airplane Wednesday on an 11-hour flight, and at the same time, the Federal Reserve was making the rest of my year.
Nice when they can do that for you.
Oh, that was such a beautiful statement, you know, a little strength in the economy, maybe the housing market's found a bottom. Yes, we're still vigilant and worried about inflation, which they always are, but I couldn't have written a better statement than that. And you saw what happened to the market. We had the best week since the summer.
But, I mean, where does it all go? What does it all mean? Is this like a real thing, or is it just a bunch of people sort of talking through their hats?
There are little areas here or there that feel a little inflated, you know, but by and large, the market feels very good. It backs up a little bit.
Back up for a second, because here's the thing I want to know. It's all about numbers on Wall Street, right? You've got the Dow does this and this does that. What does it mean?
No, it's not. It's about money and it's about fear and it's about greed and all the important things in life.
Well, those are all emotions. I guess that's my point. What is it when you say the market feels good? What does that mean?
Didn't we just established mutually that it's all about emotion and the market feels good. Hmm. They feel that the economy is not too hot. It's not too cold. We've been through all that Goldilocks stuff. We have job gains, not so much that you worry about inflation, but they're pretty steady. Corporate earnings keeps coming in pretty good. And you can always go through and you can point out any area that's weak, you know, a little area that's weak here or there. Mm-hmm. But I'm telling you, all those housing stocks were strong today, and that's money going in. That's money making a bet that the economy's in good shape. And the transportation average, which I argue is the best leading indicator out there because it's a reflection of stuff being shipped and commerce. And the Dow transportation average hit a new all-time high today. And that's good stuff.
But the comeback to that would be, you know, we're still trying to feel the bottom of the housing market. I mean, it's sort of money that's chasing itself down the stairs there.
Kai, wait a minute. Open the window. Look outside. You live in California.
I do.
This is not the real world.
Yeah, well, that's true.
It's different. No, I don't. There's still pockets of weakness, but by and large, this thing looks all right. We saw oil prices move a little bit higher, but nobody seemed to worry, and certainly not those yahoos in Chicago. Did you talk to any of those guys?
No, I didn't, but I imagine they're having a grand old time up there.
Oh, these floor traders who are animated, you know. Exactly. They're all wearing weird hats and you know, playing tricks on each other. But they're all excited because the Bears are going into the Super Bowl. And now here's the interesting thing. The Super Bowl, you know, is one of those great leading indicators. And the story is that if the NFC representative wins or if an original NFL team wins, then the stock market goes up. Well, both teams are old NFC or NFL teams, and so it's a lock. I feel like the definition of agnostic is a guy who can watch Notre Dame play Southern Methodist and not care who wins. It's that kind of a situation.
David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend.
All right, you too. Coming up, the skinny on those runway shows.
It's really unsettling, and worse yet, it's a distraction from the clothes. You really want to see the clothes. You don't want to see the elbow and knee joints.
Lordy, no. But first, let's do the numbers. blue chips struggled to the finish line today. A handful of weak performers pushed the Dow 20 points lower to 12,653. It's about a 10%, but the other benchmarks traded higher. The NASDAQ has closed up 6 days in a row now. That's its longest winning streak in 4 months. It gained a third of 1%, up 7 points to 2475. The S&P 500 rose 2 points to 1448, a gain of almost 0.2% there. For the week, the Dow rallied 1.3%. The NASDAQ grew 1.7%. The S&P 500 climbed 1.8%. That's its best week in almost 6 months. A plunge in metal prices proved to be one of the market's weakest links. Shares of Dow component Alcoa were down more than 1% today. Bond prices were higher. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 4.82%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, managing money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, President Bush releases his spending proposal for the upcoming budget year. A Senate committee holds a hearing on genocide. And the Committee to Protect Journalists releases its annual report on the status of press freedom around the world. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Have a good weekend.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There was a bit of economic policy news that kind of snuck in under the radar this week. I'm guessing it got lost between the GDP and unemployment reports. In his big State of the Economy speech Wednesday, President Bush asked Congress to extend what's called fast-track negotiating authority. That's where he gets to make trade deals that Congress can't really change. A key member of the new Democratic majority, Ways and Means Committee Chairman Charlie Rangel, said he's willing to work with the White House to make fast-track happen. That's the high-profile side of global trade negotiations. But most of the hard work is done behind closed doors. And our Stephen Beard has been trying to learn some of the tricks of the trade from the people doing the heavy lifting.
Typically, negotiators have robust authority, aren't afraid of conflict. You have to have a stomach for negotiation. It's not pretty.
Charlene Barshefsky has a needle-sharp brain, but a thick skin also came in handy as a U.S. trade negotiator in the 1990s.
I've been in rooms where the other negotiator bangs the fist on the table, scowls, glares, gets up, walks out.
Often just tactical maneuvers, part of the emotional warfare involved in trade bargaining. Sleep deprivation is another weapon, says Zadie Minton-Beddoes, a veteran observer of trade talks for The Economist magazine.
Basically, nobody does anything very much all day, and then you negotiate all through the night. And there always is a kind of marathon, last-minute, all-night negotiation, and those negotiators who can survive on the least sleep and don't mind kind of carrying on at 3 a.m. are the ones that do best.
The ones who usually do best behind closed doors are the Americans and the Europeans. For one thing, they have on their side of the table the trade negotiators' ultimate weapon, lawyers.
They have one lawyer for every single paragraph that you are negotiating, and you are here sitting there negotiating the whole text by yourself.
Eileen Kwa, co-author of Behind the Scenes at the WTO.
So you could have one person versus 20 people on the other side. I mean, this is how unequal it is.
And, of course, the US and the EU have more bargaining power, bigger markets to open or close, aid to offer or withhold. Kwa claims that some poor African countries have been quietly threatened with the loss of aid unless they accept the US or EU line. They've had to succumb.
Definitely, because for many of the, you know, small, low-income countries, it makes up to 40% of their budgets.
Samuel Armu is trade negotiator for the West African state of Benin. Representing his country's cotton farmers in the WTO talks, he's had virtually no leverage.
It's very tough. It's not easy to be able to make their case.
So far, he's failed to persuade the U.S. to stop subsidizing American cotton farmers. Increasingly, he and his colleagues look beyond the closed doors of the negotiating room and aim their message at the American public. At a news conference, his trade minister made his point sartorially.
He wore a dark suit, a dark shirt with a white tie, and he began his statement saying, "I am mourning." Why? Because these African cotton farmers are dying.
Which will prove more effective, public theater or private arm twisting? We'll only know for sure when the negotiators buckle down and get bargaining again. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Maybe we're just not very sports-minded around here, but it occurred to me this morning there's no Marketplace Super Bowl pool running this year. Just as an educated guess, I'd say we're kind of unusual, if only because of the amount of money that is bet on that game. Hundreds of millions of dollars legally in Las Vegas, as much as $8 billion illegally. A lot of that money's gone online the past several years, but bets on this year's Super Bowl 41 could be good for more old-fashioned bookies. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports now on Internet gambling.
Last year, worldwide, the internet gambling industry took in an estimated $12 billion. About half came from Americans, according to Capital HQ gaming analyst Michael Tu.
1 year ago, United States citizens comprised upwards of 50% of the entire industry's revenues.
This year won't be so profitable. New laws take effect banning the use of credit cards and electronic fund transfers for online gambling. The government has already frozen the assets of two companies, tying up online wagers in financial limbo. David Schwartz is director of the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. He says gamblers may have a hard time getting money back from these unregulated companies.
You might be able to fly out to Costa Rica or the Isle of Man, perhaps, and do something, but if you can't do that, you're really out of luck.
Leery of having their own funds frozen, thousands of other online gambling websites have stopped doing business with U.S. customers. But Schwartz thinks this disruption is only temporary.
Even though it's getting more challenging, it seems that every time one avenue of payment is closed, another opens up. So I think it's probably inevitable that somebody is going to leap into the fray. A company that doesn't have any U.S. exposure will accept the money and facilitate payments for online gambling.
And the crackdown on internet gambling could also be vulnerable to challenge under international trade law. The European Union has described the U.S. actions as protectionist and threatened legal action at the World Trade Organization. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
All eyes in the fashion world are on New York City. It's a solid week of see and be seen at a phenomenon called Fashion Week. Models will be parading the newest and hippest looks down the runways. But this season's biggest debate isn't whether hemlines are above the knee or below. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more now from New York.
Another season, but the same skinny models.
I'm a model, you know what I mean, and I do my little turn on the catwalk. Yeah, on the catwalk, yeah, I shake my little tush on the catwalk.
Those little tushes may be too little. The industry's worried that young women are starving themselves to stay on the catwalks. The fashion world scoffed when Madrid took the drastic step last year of banning any models it deemed too skinny. But the snickering stopped when a Brazilian model died last month from complications of anorexia. New York, Paris, and Milan aren't mandating boxing-style weigh-ins just yet. But nobody's sure the common-sense guidelines they're offering up instead can keep models healthy either, especially in an industry where looks are everything, and the look is decidedly thin.
We all choose those models, and we're all part of those images that are completely unrealistic. And I think it really starts with educating the industry.
Magali Amade is a model and actress. She's appeared in top fashion magazines like Vogue and Elle. After struggling with bulimia for 7 years, she made a second career talking about the dangers of eating disorders. She says it's become acceptable for victims of illnesses like alcoholism to talk about their struggles publicly.
But very rarely, I can probably guess, very rarely have you been to a dinner party where someone says, oh, you know, I used to be an anorexic, I don't diet, sure, I'll have, you know, a second piece of dessert. It's just not something that people are comfortable talking about.
Of course, culture's been telling women what to look like for centuries. Harold Cota's curator of the Costume Institute at the Metropolitan Museum. He says, oddly enough, the quest for thinness started when styles changed at the turn of the last century and women stopped being able to rely on corsets.
So if you needed a slender waist, it meant it had to be your body.
But even some designers agree that today's insistence on skeletal models is too much. Tim Gunn chairs the fashion design department at Parsons School of Design.
I don't want to sit and watch a runway show and wince and recoil because that model on the runway looks like she should be in the hospital bed. It's really unsettling. And worse yet, it's a distraction from the clothes. You really want to see the clothes. You don't want to see the elbow and knee joints.
Still, he says clothes do look more elegant on lithe figures than those with bulging bellies or double-wide backsides. So what's the answer? Gunn says he's not sure, but that it's not New York's suggestion to have young models sleep more. Nor is it offering healthier food backstage at the fashion shows.
If I'm used to smoking a pack of cigarettes before a show and having a glass of champagne, if the cigarettes and the champagne aren't there, am I going to go eat the broccoli? I don't think so.
Maybe not. But the Costume Institute's Harold Cota wonders whether all this angst is misplaced.
No, I think that the focus of the debate is it's not proportional to the real impact, which is not to say that it isn't real, but that it is looking at something that is associated with a world of glamour and luxury, whereas obesity, which lives and exists in our community, is just simply not that glamorous.
Meanwhile, rangy-limbed young women will strut down New York's runways until next Friday. Maybe the spring shows will have some size 16 models. Or at least a few twos. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on a Friday afternoon, it's the end of the week and the verdict is in, guilty. Former Coca-Cola Secretary Joya Williams was found guilty of conspiring to steal trade secrets from the company and sell them to the highest bidder. Get this, Pepsi's actually the one that turned her in. Williams could face 10 years in jail. She claimed she was duped by two ex-cons. Edward Grand just fessed right up before his trial. The former Duracell employee admitted stealing his former company's trade secrets today. His sentencing is scheduled for April. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 20 points, about a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq gained 7 points, a third of a percent. The S&P 500 rose 2 points, almost 2/10 of 1% there. It was a better week all in all than that, though. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Coming up Monday, smokers don't have to wring their hands over quitting anymore. Now they can just use them to quit.
You know, you can sit in a boardroom or an airplane, rub it on your hands, and no one even knows you're doing it. But you're getting the satisfaction you would out of that cigarette.
And hey, no secondhand smoke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.